want joy in the world, right? Like, what do you do when you are, when you have been, you come home from a long day and you are bogged down, you're exhausted and drained. Where do you go? We go to the clowns and the comedians, and we do that to, as a reparative thing. But yeah, I'm thinking again back of what you said about challenging these institutions and challenging capitalistic metrics of failure, and in what ways can comedy and satire actually feasibly, measurably, actionably challenge these, and what does it provide? What is it for?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about pleasure activism and just the role of pleasure in making art in general and relating to people. And actually, one funny way kind of comedy sort of slipped into my life is recently I went to a really great New Year's Day party.
And here is where June told me her New Year's Day party story you heard earlier.
And I found this disco ball on the DJ booth. And it was being passed around the room, and people were like giving it good party energy and passing it to the next person.
The gift economy of the disco ball, passing it around a room full of adults, a simple act that unlocked communal joy, an impulse to re-enchant an otherwise grown-up gathering.
That was sort of like a glimpse into this question that I've been having. Like, what is the role of pleasure and comedy now? And it kind of started to crack that open for me, and I felt like, oh, maybe it's in places like this. It doesn't have to necessarily be on a stage or written on a grant or, you know, written academically about it, but it's actually like happening all the time if we can frame it in such a way that there is a sense of play and reciprocity. We don't even have to call it clown. We can just call it reciprocity.
Yeah, it's magic. You were sharing magic.
Yeah, it was amazing. The people like brought out their dance moves, and they were like boogieing to this like tiny little disco ball all night. It was all day. It was so great. People were lit up.
I love that so much.
Yeah, and at the very end, everyone was like, disco, yeah. Like, there was like this weird synergy that happened just around this like one little item. But I don't know, there's maybe something in that. But it's a continuous question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's as good a place as any to end with the sharing of magic, the enchantment found in a disco ball at a New Year's Day party. that's beautiful. Yeah, thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing your magic with us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Discovery, disability, disco balls. June made me think a lot about what messes and magic from my life I had been ignoring or pathologizing with internalized ableism as a fellow neurodivergent artist. Studying it doesn't mean that I never do it. But ultimately, hearing June talk and seeing her performance work just made me miss playing in that brazen, childlike way that places process over product and transforms failure into joy, and without a second thought, shares that enchantment with everyone at the party. I'm Torin Caffaretta. Thanks for dropping by after school.
Many thanks to June Fukumura and Torian Caffarata for sharing this candid conversation on failure and our ability to re-enchant the everyday. FCAT After School is produced by Emma Jean, Torian Caffarata, and Stephanie Werner, with help from Stu Pop and Tessa Perkins Deneau. We respectfully acknowledge the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, Katsi, Kwikwetlem, Kakite, Kwantlen, Semiamu, and Sawasins peoples, on whose unceded traditional territories our three campuses reside, and where many of the stories shared in our series take place. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to leave us a rating and subscribe to FCAT After School wherever you listen to podcasts. You can follow us on social media at fcat@sfu. That's F-C-A-T at SFU across all platforms. For feedback or guest suggestions, reach us by email at fcateng@sfu.ca. All links in the show notes. See you next time.
Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, June 14th, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. In 1971, Tommy Douglas, today commonly recognized as the father of universal healthcare in Canada, and his friend and political mentor M.J. Coldwell were honored with the establishment of the Douglas Coldwell Foundation, a charitable organization built to promote education and research into social democracy. In 2022, the foundation was renamed to include the Layton name, in honor of the late, great Jack Layton. Since its founding, the organization has partnered with many other social justice-minded groups to achieve its mission of promoting the principles of social democracy. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble editor Nick Seabrook joins executive director of the Douglas Coldwell Layton Foundation to talk about the history of the organization and current research projects and initiatives. Here are Josh Biesjack and Nick Seabrook in conversation. Take a listen.
Hello, I'm here today with Josh Biesjack, the Executive Director of the Douglas Coldwell Layton Foundation, an organization dedicated to promoting social democratic values through research and education and engaging in public policy. So, Josh, welcome to Rabble Radio.
All right, thank you very much, Nick. It's really nice to be here.
First, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure, that's a great way to start. Originally born and raised in Toronto in the West End. I grew up in the Junction area, working class family. My father was a hardwood floor guy, and my mom took care of the books and myself and my two other siblings. I got involved in politics in the David Miller election in 2003 for mayor after attending an anti-war rally in 2002, where I met David Miller. But I also met Jack Layton and Olivia Chow and Sherry DeNovo, who was then a reverend at the United Church over on Roncesvalles, and a few other important people. So 2003 was interesting for the mayor, but Jack Layton also became the leader of the federal NDP. There was an election coming up in 2004, and I had been doing some charitable work actually at Sherry DeNovo's church, and she suggested that I might want to get involved in Peggy Nash's campaign. And so one evening I was walking home and I popped into their campaign office and volunteered, which was really cool. So I ended up getting to work on those campaigns. Prior to politics, I had had a couple of small businesses and done some work in sales. And Michael Lewis found out about my business experience and thought it'd be interesting, see if I wanted to come down and help with some fundraising at the Ontario NDP head office. And next thing you know, I was working with him. So it wasn't that long before I ended up working for the party full time. In 2011, after Jack Layton passed away, I was approached to see if I wanted to help get the Broadbent Institute off the ground with Kathleen Monk. My wife, Lydia, was already living in Ottawa. She was Jack Layton's major donor fundraiser. And so it made sense for me to make the move to Ottawa. So in 2012, myself and Kathleen Monk officially launched the Broadbent Institute. It was extremely successful. I spent a decade there getting that organization off the ground. It was the thrill of my life to work with Ed Broadbent so closely. And then in 2021, well, I guess the opportunity came for me to take over the Douglas Coldwell Layton Foundation. But that was after about 4 years of me sitting on the board and volunteering and doing the administrative work for the organization before all of that happened. And so it's my pleasure now to not only revitalize this organization, but also grow it. And we could talk a little bit more about what that has looked like.
All right, that sounds good. For some of our listeners who might not know, could you tell us a little bit about the history of the Douglas Caldwell Layton Foundation and what it's all about?
Sure, absolutely. So the Douglas Caldwell Foundation, as it was originally known, was founded or established in 1971 by Tommy Douglas as he was exiting federal politics. And for people who don't know, the Caldwell in the name is for M.J. Caldwell, another leader of the CCF, and really Tommy Douglas's political mentor. At the time of the establishment, Tommy insisted that M.J. Caldwell be included in the name and in the foundation for his contributions to social democracy in Canada. So this foundation became a big part of Tommy's life. And he traveled the country talking with people, talking with folks about the work that he wanted to do. And for the most part, he was the face of the organization for the first number of years. Now, in 1986, when he passed away, the leadership of the organization moved to his daughter, Shirley Douglas. Now, Shirley Douglas, being a pretty famous actor, was torn between her home in Toronto, LA, and New York City, and didn't have quite as much time to dedicate to the work of the foundation. Over the course of the next 20 years, the organization's day-to-day activities really fell to a volunteer board who kept the lights on and kept the organization moving forward. However, the activities of the organization slowed down simply because people were very busy. And so in 2017, the organization was run by a board of directors who were completely volunteer with some administrative help to make sure that the books and the finances were in order. But it had mostly become an organization that provided scholarships to students in memory of social democratic leaders across the country, and then also providing grants to social democratic activities, research projects, or academic endeavors. But the organization itself was not actively doing work that it would publish itself or initiate itself, mm-hmm. simply again because we had this volunteer board who were really quite incredible, really dedicated to make sure this organization stayed alive, that remained active. However, we didn't, you know, our membership over time had really decreased. There wasn't any active fundraising going on. There wasn't really a vision for where the organization would go. So in 2017, I was at the Ascension in Montreal, and the former president, David McKenzie, approached myself wondering if I wanted a gift from the Douglas Caldwell Foundation for the Broadbent Institute. I was there, obviously representing the Institute. I, of course, said yes. Yeah, sure, I'll take a gift. And, you know, I had to ask the question, you know, why would the DCF want to make that kind of a gift to us? And he said, well, the board was thinking about closing down the charity because it wasn't as active as they wanted it to be. And the board didn't have the time to do the work. And they felt that the Broadbent Institute, by and large, was doing some really great stuff and wanted to move it forward. Now, interestingly enough, at that time, myself and the executive director of the Broadbent Institute, Rick Smith, as well as members of the board, wanted to establish a charity, so a Broadbent Foundation. However, we had had some issues trying to get charitable status for that with the CRA. So in stark contrast, you have the Douglas Caldwell Foundation that is a registered charity. It's been around for almost 50 years at that point. And we had aligned values. So the idea was, why not help get the Douglas Caldwell Foundation back up off the ground, doing the charitable work that the Broadbent Institute wasn't focused on doing. Broadbent Institute, obviously not being a charity, is much more focused on political action, mm-hmm. Political commentary. They're able to very effectively fight conservatism in the country, as well as some of those far-right movements that have taken over some of our politics, sadly, in the country. However, the Douglas Caldwell Foundation could do a lot of that educational work, a lot of the research work, a lot of that charitable stuff, and it would be beneficial to all of our efforts, I guess, to work together. So I set about working with the charity, getting its books in order. We had to revitalize the members who were on the board, people who wanted to stay and get active, people who had been there a long time, who wanted to step aside and let some new people come in. And then we had to change the bylaws of the organization to allow for full-time staff to be hired, as well as some other updates that needed to happen for an organization to really flourish and grow. So in 2021, with a new board, a new set of bylaws, I was offered the opportunity to come on board as the executive director. At first, it was actually a part-time position while I also wound things up at the Broadbent Institute and was able to help transition the organization from me being the director of development to the new director of development, being Devin Crick, who I'm sure many people know, a great person. And so it wasn't really until July of 2021 that I started full-time as the executive director. And there was a lot of work to be done. Believe me when I say, you know, we had to start from scratch. And in many ways, it's more difficult to take an old organization and try to revitalize it and rebrand it as opposed to just starting fresh or starting anew.
And I just had a question about that change in direction, because I know that one of the changes in 2022, you began doing peer-reviewed research. And can you tell me a little bit about the decision to go into that direction of peer-reviewed research?
Sure. I decided that I wanted to start from Tommy Douglas's instructions to us, the caretakers of his charity. So I went back to the founding documents. And so I listened to Tommy Douglas's speeches that had taken place. Then I took a look at the letters of patent. This charity did not have an office. It had some storage space that was rented. And then you had members of the board who had agreed to take on volunteer space, really, for people to store different archival documents and such. So it took a while to sort of bring all those things together and go through all that archival document, all those archival documents and pieces in order to see what was really there. We uncovered the original letters of patent, a fascinating document, which really changed the course of the organization. So in those letters of patent, it states that our purpose is to educate people about government, about politics, and about civil society. So that's the mandate. That is the first part of the letters of patent in terms of what the purpose of the organization is. The second part is how we go about that educational process. And it clearly states that we are to have seminars, lectures, original research, peer-reviewed research, academic publications. There's also some scholarships and some grants that are also written in there. So in that document, I've got the purpose for the organization, and then I also have exactly how to go about it. And on those letters of patent, you've got Tommy Douglas's signature, as well as the other founding members of the charity, who by and large were instrumental in not only this charity, but they're also key figures that played a role in both the CCF and the formation of the NDP when the CCF merged with the CLC to form the New Democratic Party of Canada. So you have some incredible legends who are attached to this organization. So if that was its purpose and the charity had not been living up to its purpose, I decided that it was our job to go ahead and live up to Tommy Douglas's vision, our founder's vision for what it was we were supposed to be doing. Otherwise, we would doing the exact opposite. It would be a complete shame to have wasted all of that energy and time if we weren't going to move forward. And so it seemed like a natural fit. It's something that we had always talked about doing, but we had never gotten a chance to move forward with it. And so when you think about Tommy Douglas, when you think about the NDP, you think about the rich history of social democratic leaders in the country, you can't help but think about universal healthcare. Mm-hmm. It's a great pride of our country. Tommy Douglas was voted the greatest Canadian because of universal healthcare.
I remember that. That was a CBC program in the early 2000s.
It was indeed. unbelievable. So that's Tommy Douglas, the greatest Canadian. So I decided, why not look at what could be done in terms of research on healthcare related issues? And that's sort of been a running theme ever since. And so in 2002, we launched our first project, or at least we got it started, looking on mental health and wellness in the workplace. And I can talk a little bit more about that because I'm happy to.
Absolutely. I'd be very interested. I think you said 2002, but I think you meant 2022.
I did mean 2022. You're absolutely right.
So tell me a little bit about some of these topics that you've researched. I understand you've researched mental health in the workplace, like you mentioned, and also long-term care.
Yeah, sure. Happy to talk about that. So again, I do want to say, though, part of the revitalization, the renewal of the organization did come thanks to bringing in Jack Layton's legacy. And so Olivia Chow is a good friend of both mine and my wife's, Lydia Treadwell. Mike Layton and Sarah Layton, also very good friends of mine. When they found out that I was coming here to the foundation, they thought that would be just the perfect fit to bring Jack Layton's legacy into a strong organization with a clear vision for how we could educate people not only about democracy and government and politics, but then also about social democracy and the benefits of it. Okay, so going into the research. So the first project in 2022 that we launched was on mental health and wellness in the workplace. Now, keep in mind, you know, the country and the world are coming out of the global pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. And a lot of people are talking about mental health. We know that there are people suffering. We know that there is a serious crisis in this country when it comes to mental health, especially coming out of the pandemic. And, you know, you had a lot of big companies even with awareness campaigns on mental health. You know, I'm sure everybody knows about the Bell Canada Let's Talk campaign. However, it bothered me that no one was talking about the root causes of these mental health issues. And so I wanted to look at that. And so we did some preliminary research, and it came back that a lot of people's mental health or their mental health distress was stemming from issues related to their work environment. And so we thought that would be a great place to start. So before we got into any kind of a prescription or, you know, talked about what services should be offered, we thought it'd be first most important to understand what was happening in people's work environments. And everybody has a different work environment. Everybody has different stresses. And so we wanted to study those impacts. So the types of work, the work environments, also the compensation that people receive for their labor and how that all fits in. And so we ended up with a really detailed research project. By the end of it, we had a national survey done that focused on full-time workers and people from all sorts of work, from the public service. We had people who were teachers, people who were nurses, people working in the building trades, people working in offices, in retail jobs. You know, it was really quite extensive. Mm-hmm. And so we collected all of this data. By the time we were done, we had more than 70 pieces of data collected for each individual that we had surveyed relating to their mental health, but then also looking at their workplace, their work environment. You know, it was quite astounding, actually. What we were able to uncover was incredible. And we were able to share that data with employers, with unions, with policymakers at every level of government. And so it was a great way for us to launch these new initiatives looking at mental health. And I will say that project in no way is over. That is a project that is ongoing because there are so many different aspects to look at. And there's opportunity there for us to dig down into different work environments, different professions, and different places that people work.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Douglas Cole Layton Foundation, going through just all of the things that are offered on the Douglas Cole Foundation website, I highly encourage our listeners to go and visit and see some of the great things that are there. I wanted to give you an opportunity, Josh, just to highlight a few of the things that you want our listeners to take away in these last couple of minutes that we have left.
You know, this organization has grown very quickly. You know, Jack Layton told me once, never let money get in the way of a good idea. Mm-hmm. And so we've put a lot of effort into going out and getting that funding. And it's thanks to individuals who make donations, who become members, that we're able to do all this work. So I want to, right off the bat, say thank you to everybody who's helped us get off the ground. I want to thank our partners. We have a number of union partners who help us, the United Steelworkers, United Food and Commercial Workers, UFCW, MAPSIO, Canadian Teachers Federation, PIPS, the Professional Employees Union, and LIUNA 1611. Those partners make our work possible. That said, we have some exciting things going on. You may have seen the lecture series. We now have 6 annual lecture events at 6 different universities in 6 different cities. At the U of T, at McGill, Mount St. Vincent University, University of Victoria, and Carleton University, brand new this year through their Masters of Political Management program, the MPM program. Oh, and the University of Winnipeg. All of them are on different topics related to democracy, government, politics, with a focus on social democracy and how social democracy makes our society better. I highly encourage people to take a look at the lecture series. That's really new and exciting. You mentioned the Alexa McDonough Women's Leadership Center. That is a place for us to tell the stories of success, triumph of women leaders, social democratic leaders in this country who have paved the way for everyone. I'll encourage people to definitely take a look at that. If you knew Jack Layton or you love Jack Layton, you love the story of Jack Layton, please do come to the website and check out the Layton Legacy and what's offered there. We do a number of training programs through the Layton Legacy. The next one will be in September in Toronto, both in person and online. I encourage people to come. That's community leadership training through the Jack Layton Legacy at the Douglas Caldwell Layton Foundation. And everybody's invited to attend and get involved.
Absolutely. And listeners should know that we do plan on having more coverage of the great work happening at the Douglas Caldwell Layton Foundation, both on podcast and in our written form on the rabble.ca website. I also want to thank Josh for taking the time to be with us today. And also the Douglas Caldwell Layton Foundation, as Josh mentioned, has been a great partner to Rabble for many years, including on our crucial Jack Layton Fellowship for Change program, where we bring in a young journalist and train them for their future and their career. Very rewarding program, both for the student and for us, the teachers. Josh, thank you so much again for being here today.
Thanks, Nick. I look forward to doing it again.
Rabble editor Nick Seabrook and executive director of the Douglas Caldwell Layton Foundation, Josh Bizjack, in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Nick and Josh. To learn more about how the DCL partners with Rabble, be sure to check out the Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellowship on rabble.ca. And to discover the current research projects and initiatives of the DCL, please be sure to visit douglascaldwelllayton.ca. Switching gears now, let's review the top stories on rabble.ca in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn things back over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in labor news, an international human rights organization will be turning its lens against the Canadian Human Rights Commission. For years, the Canadian Human Rights Commission has faced accusations of discrimination and bias against its own Black employees. Now, the Global Alliance of National Human Rights Institutions is examining the Canadian Human Rights Commission's record, and if these accusations are found to be valid, it could put the Commission's status as a recognized United Nations human rights organization at risk. Rabble Labor Beat reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga reports, the Canadian Black Action Secretariat is condemning the Canadian Human Rights Commission for failing to act to end discrimination within its organization. The Secretariat has been pursuing legal action against the Canadian Human Rights Commission for years of discrimination against Black employees and has issued recommendations for improvement which have been ignored. Marcus Thompson, Chief Executive Officer of the Black Class Action Secretariat, said the special review of the Canadian Human Rights Commission puts Canada on the same level as oppressive states like Iraq, Russia, and Venezuela. In national news, in an op-ed for Rabble, John Price, professor emeritus at the University of Victoria, is warning about Bill C-70, which he says is being rushed through Parliament without proper oversight. The bill